Hello and welcome to back to Millennial 2019. This is the fifth night. I've got a lineup of four guests coming up. That's Edward Dutton, the Jolly Heretic, and then Unwashed, then the Distributist, and then Dangerfield.
Tonight.
Back
to Millennial 2019.
Sorry, this is the technical error there. Okay, but first, Edward Dutton, the Jolly Heretic. So, should I call you Ed?
Yes.
Okay. Ed, thank you for taking part in Millennial 2019 and welcome to the show.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Excellent. So first, could you introduce yourself? Because you arrived on YouTube, or at least arrived into my awareness of YouTube, about 6 months ago, or perhaps 9 months ago. So for I think for me and for other people, there it is a sudden arrival. So could you introduce yourself and explain what you do and who you are?
Hello, my name is Ed Dutton, and I'm an independent researcher. And I do books and academic research and things on these naughty subjects that we're increasingly not allowed to touch. And it's unfortunately precisely because they're naughty that I'm attracted to them. So that's kind of the way it is, really. And it had never occurred to me to get involved in any of this YouTube stuff till I was interviewed by a chap called James Dellingpole. And he had one of these podcasts called The Delling Pod about my book, At Our Wit's End, Why We're Becoming Less Intelligent and What It Means for the Future. And then I checked his what was going on with his video. I was like, crikey, this gets serious. Serious numbers of people are watching this. And then with my own self-published books, unlike the ones that are published by publishers, I was able to track how much they sell. And I noted a significant rise in how much they were selling. And I thought, God, this is a bit of all right, isn't it? And until then, I'd only used YouTube for watching old videos of stuff from the 80s or 90s or whatever that people had kindly uploaded. I hadn't really watched that many of these. I was aware of you from your various controversial television-worthy activities in the USA or whatever. But I really wasn't aware of this whole thing. And so then I thought, well, people have been saying to me for ages that you should do YouTube videos. You know, people might like them. So I thought, oh, I'll give it a go. And it kind of just went from there, really. And
you've never looked back?
No, I've never looked back. No, people just seemed to like them. And then there was a few. I was asked to go on various shows. One of them that seemed to do it a lot of credit in terms of getting subscribers was Red Ice.
The thumbnail for that was quite hilarious.
Yeah, and then YouTube. I mean, so far I've only had one strike. I'm currently on a strike. So I think I'm doing just. I've got to be a good boy till February, assuming they don't just call me. So it's gone all right. So yeah, I quite enjoy doing them, and it's been very interesting, and it's kind of helped out my research because the viewers come in with interesting ideas and whatever. And then once a week I do a live stream with my colleague Dr. Michael Woodley of Manee, it wasn't anything planned or anything. It just sort of happened.
So it's a common story. I think that I, the Iconoclast, and there was a third one last night who said the same thing, that it just sort of happened by accident.
Yeah, exactly. There was no planning involved at all. It was only that I think I did a speech at a conference some years ago at the London Conference on Intelligence about, it's called The Mutant Says in His Heart There Is No God. It was how atheists have high levels of mutation and that's why they're maladapted and don't have children and are physically and mentally ill and would die under conditions of Darwinian selection. And I did a presentation on that, which people seemed to quite like, but then it had to be taken down for all kinds of naughty reasons to do with protests and things. But it was after that people said to me, a number of different people just said, you should give it a go. You might, you'd be good. I don't know. So I know. I being 39, and but I thought this is for the young people, isn't it? This is for the people in their 20s with their Snapchats and their pet shops and their whatever they have, you know, the Instagram. But it seems to have gone. I'm happy anyway that some people at least don't think it's too ghastly.
Oh, it's very good. And I imagine that you've really taken to live streaming because you are a very good live performer, so to speak. I don't mean that to imply any sort of insincerity, but you did very well.
I did get a star in GCSE drama. so which is the English equivalent of the higher of the standard grades. But then nothing since. But no, yeah, I quite like it. Yeah, it's good fun. I enjoy doing it, and my hobby before that was genealogy and tracing the family tree. This is far more interesting. So I think I'll stick with it for a while. I think that's the plan.
Yeah, I think you're doing very well. Now, before I proceed, somebody has asked again whether I'm in a gay disco. No, I'm not. The lighting is bisexual, according to somebody, I think it was JF, but no, it's not a gay disco. Now, I did, again, I've changed the camera setup slightly to try to make myself occupy less of the frame, because someone said it was distracting. So this is a temporary setup just now. I hope it's all right. I think it's maybe a wee bit better than for the last few nights. Anyway, doesn't matter. It's just supposed to look Christmassy. So those are Christmas lights in the background. I hope it's festive. So let's get to it. Ed, you wanted to talk about, you agreed to talk about this decade, the 2010s. We're about to leave this decade. It's about to be over. So reflections on this decade. You take it away.
Well, yes, I think it's been a kind of, let me just grab something to say. It's been a decade of increasing polarization. That's how I would see it. So on the one hand, in Britain at the beginning of the decade, what did we have? We had New Labour in power, we had Gordon Brown, we had the financial crisis and whatever, but we had Gordon Brown, we had the Labour that was in power, and now here we are, almost 10 years later, and Labour have been just strangled, just emasculated, castrated. By all accounts, they sit in Parliament with glum, hangdog expressions, their salty tears staining the green carpet. You know, it's a kind of a wonderful thing for a British person to see. But it's not just that the right have taken power or something, and that's obviously not true. What there is it seems to be, is an increasing polarisation over the last decade, whereby the left have become much more extreme. So we see this in, of course, this wokeness, this insanity at the moment in the UK about this woman who was sacked for tweeting in her spare time that a man can't change into a woman or whatever it was. And then this Maya Hofstadter, is that her name, or Forstadter or something? And this judge said that her view, which is just basically an empirically accurate view based on science and reason, has no place, is worthy of no respect in a democratic society. Those were his words, which is, I mean, tells you of the insanity of the sort of Kali Yuga bonkers mental face situation that we've got ourselves into. But on the other hand, there is this other movement, this other pull, which you see in Trump, which you see in Brexit, which you see in the vote for Donald Trump, Boris Johnson, which was underpinned by activity, particularly in the northeast of England and in the Midlands, in working class, traditional Labour areas, this movement to the right. And you see research, there's growing research on this. There's a book published last year called The Identitarians by Zucchetti, his name is, he's a Portuguese researcher, which looks at the growth of this, and it looks at the growth of this cultural movement as a means of, kind of in a Gramscian way, preparing society for people like Salvini and Liga and all these kinds of groups. And so you could say that it's a kind of polarization that's gone in two directions. On the one hand, the woke has become more woke, but the people that are the conservative have in some senses become more conservative, and ideas which would have been anathema 10 years ago, such as critiquing multiculturalism or whatever, have become much more mainstream.
Well, I think that's, I wouldn't want to overstate the degree to which the right has radicalized. I think it's nowhere near close to how much the left have radicalized.
No,
I mean, the mainstream left, we're not talking about the fringes or something going on social media. The mainstream, I mean, that Ash Sarkar.
Yes, they are.
She's now wheeled onto the BBC to represent the left, and she's described herself as literally a communist.
But she's a bit of an anomaly in the sense that she has special pleading because of a certain physiological aspects to her. But yeah, it's true. The left have become much more extreme over the last decade. But equally, it's not like the right have just gone along with it. There is a kind of a pulling back. And what you see, interestingly, I mean, if you look at the research of Peter Turkin, who's a Russian researcher based in the USA, and he looks at the thing, when a society is polarizing, when it's basically moving towards a civil war or a low-level civil war or whatever, there's a number of things that you note. One of these is simply too many workers, which is what the left have created over the last decade in particular with their massive, massive immigration, or the last two decades, with their massive, massive immigration. Too many workers means poor wages, means unhappy people, means people who don't feel their life's going anywhere, means change they don't like and whatever. That's one thing. Another thing is what they call intra-elite competition, he argues. So this is the one of the things that the left was obsessed with in the UK anyway, has been educating people. This idea that everyone has to go to university, that what's going on here? Everyone has to go to university and whatever, and the consequence is that about half of young people in the UK now go to university. So it undermines university and it's meaningless, but interestingly, you get all these people who are you still there, Woz?
Yes, I'm here. I'm listening.
I can only see me on the screen.
Don't worry.
I'm not worried. I'm just I am slightly worried. But you get this intra-elite competition caused by this over-promoted society where you get, let's say, far too many lawyers, far too many people qualified as lawyers to be lawyers. And those people become resentful, and then you get competition within the elite for these spaces, and you get polarization along various lines in attempts to attain power. That's the second thing that he argues is definitely happening. Then you get state fragility, so you get this idea of when the state is no longer trusted. Now, this is quite interesting, because one of the things that predicts low trust is multiculturalism. The research by Robert Putnam found that if you have a multicultural society, not only does it reduce generalized trust, because people tend to trust people who are genetically similar to themselves because it helps them to pass on their genes or whatever, but it reduces trust even among the natives, because the natives essentially kind of blame each other for what's happened. And also they become acutely aware that you're going to get the possibility for collaborators among the natives who will collaborate against the other natives in their individual interests, against the group interests with the ethnic minorities. And so you get collapsing trust. And you see this in the last decade with concepts like fake news, the idea that the judges that voted against Brexit were the enemies of the people, all this sort of thing. This is another side of polarization. And the final one is simply external interference. And that's very interesting. So you could argue that Brexit had an influence on what happened subsequently in the USA, because it showed that something like that was possible. This kind of populist revolt was possible and it could work. And so then that had an effect on the USA. And then what happened in the USA had an effect perhaps on Brazil and the election of the president, the populist president there, and so on. And so he argues these conditions are all met, and he maintains that the 2020s is going to be a period of intense unrest and violence. He argues that America is in the same kind of level of polarization based on his assorted measures that it was at the time of the Civil War. So I think the key thing over the last decade has been a polarization and a pessimism, which is often part of this polarization, which hasn't gone away. If you think back to the 90s, the optimism of the 90s, the boom, the dot-com boom, and the feeling of the end of history, the end of communism, and everything was going to be fine. And then you have the 9/11, you have the Iraq war, you have the economic collapse, and there's a feeling of pessimism. There's a feeling that it's almost like society's run out.
Well, another thing that happened in Britain in the 2000s was the Expensys scandal, which I thought that was 2008. It was just around the same time as the global financial crisis. And I thought at the time that was quite a profound thing, because it completely, at the time, it completely ruptured anyone's trust in the government, in politicians, because you saw that they were just completely corrupt.
Yes, that's true. They are. And also, it's interesting as well, if you think about the kind of people that go into politics, which is another issue which has changed over our lifetimes. I mean, you're, 2 years younger than me, so you'll remember that at the beginning of the 80s, you had a foreign secretary who was a hereditary peer, Lord Carrington. You had a home secretary, William Whitelaw, who was gentry, you know, not noble, but they had lower nobility, you know, kind of gentry, landowning type. You had lots and lots of people that were, the people that were running the country were these, what there were some sociologists that called them somewheres. these people that had attachment to a specific place and to a specific family and to a specific country and to lots of traditions, the gentry and the nobility. And they didn't go into politics to make money or to get status, because they already had status and they already had money. They went into politics out of a sense of noblesse oblige, and they had these kind of group values, the kind of values that made their great uncle join up in World War One and get killed at Passchendaele or whatever, those kinds of values. And then at the other end, with the labor movement at that time, before it became full-on woke and multicultural, it was basically a movement of working class people. But okay, there was an elite aspect to it, that's true. There were the virtue signals of the time, like Clement Attlee or Michael Foot or whatever, who were in it as rich people. But a lot of them were just miners and things, of trade unionists who were working class, like Arthur Scargill, who'd gone up through the trade union, or Dennis Skinner, who got up through the trade union movement. And they had, again, these kind of groupish area local values which working class people have. And what we've seen over the last 30 years is the middle classicization of politics, whereby they're all now overwhelmingly the gentry and the nobility don't really go into politics anymore. It's a bit of a problem for them. David Cameron was of that kind of background, and he always had to be embarrassed about it, you know. And the working class really don't go into politics. It's very rare. Okay, there's some, but it's quite rare. And it's these middle class people and what middle class people have characterized by, they've always been characterized by, even if you go back to Tudor England, is individualistic values, individualistic Protestant Calvinist sort of values. And those have come to dominate Parliament. And so you shouldn't be surprised that the expenses scandal, because it reflects people that are just out for themselves. And also it reflected the fact that they were told that their salaries weren't particularly high. Ask the salaries of British politicians have never been that high, but they could make up for it with the expenses. And that's what a lot of them did. So they had a salary that wasn't anything like as high as, let's say, even MPs in Finland. But they could do this. They could make up for it with the expenses, which is what they did. Apart from the more kind of group-oriented, group-selected ones who didn't do that. And that's another interesting thing that we've seen over the last decade, which is this alliance, it seems. You've seen it with Trump, and you've seen it with Boris Johnson, perhaps, as well, between the upper class and the working class, who are both nationalistic, who have these group values, these values of family, these values of genetically normal values, frankly, the values that are ethnocentric and that mean the group survive. And they have united against what has taken over the country, which is the individualistic values. And in America, that's seen Trump. I'm not saying everything, you know, Trump has now fallen into disrepute or whatever, but that was what I think permitted it. And equally with Boris, you've seen a similar thing. You've seen these working class areas that don't share these nowhere values, and what life's about is about status and about money and about education and about morality. They're not interested in that.
Would you say that a healthy organism, a healthy social organism, is basically comprised of the upper class and the working class, and that organism is now perceiving the middle class as a sort of foreign entity that needs to be ejected?
I don't know about that. I suppose you could say that if we can talk about individual selection in Darwinian terms, and we can talk about group selection, and the group, let's say, if we talk about a beehive, the beehive that will be the optimum beehive will be the beehive that has the optimum percentage of each caste. Optimum number of queens are produced, optimum number of drones, optimum number of workers, optimum number of feeder caste, whatever the different castes are. And if that goes awry, because let's say there's a member of the feeder caste and she's some mutant and she gives too much food to this grub and too little to this and whatever, and you get too many queens and not enough drones and whatever, then that hive is likely, under Darwinian conditions, to be out-selected by another hive. And equally, it could be argued that under conditions of intense group selection and the Darwinian selection that we had until 1800, there was obviously some kind of advantage to having quite a large middle class, quite a large percentage of people with these individualistic striver values that help to produce geniuses. What are geniuses? They're basically very, very high IQ individualistic people. they are group selected in that they do things which help the group, such as a major invention that helps them in warfare or whatever. But as themselves, they're not, you know, they just do what they want because they want to do it because they're fascinated by it. But, and you have an optimum number of people like that. They're inventive. You get the Industrial Revolution because of people like this in the middle class. They make the country rich and whatever. And it, but if the percentage of them becomes too big and if their power becomes too big, then you have a problem. And the other aspect of them being individualistic is questioning things, questioning received wisdom, questioning received knowledge. That's what geniuses do. They take that, which that's why the geniuses are characterized by moderately low agreeableness, moderately low conscientiousness, because to be a genius, you have to be able to think outside the box. So be low in rule following. And you have to be able to new inventions will offend people and you have to not care about that. Or be too autistic to understand that what you're saying will offend people. Either will do. And so the problem is that if you get too many of these, then society, as a percentage, then society isn't group selective enough. These people are too powerful. If this caste is too powerful in the society, society is insufficiently group selected. And so it will, in the battle of group selection, start to lose against other groups that are more group selected. And I think that's kind of what's happening. And also, Darwinian selection has collapsed over the, you know, child mortality has gone from 40% in 1800 to 1%. So the level of group selection is been interfered with. And so you end up with a situation where we are now not group selected enough. We're too individualistic and we're up against Islam or whatever that is, okay, they're less intelligent than us, but they're highly group selected. And under previous conditions, with very, very high, with the high intelligence that we had, combined with the sort of moderate level of group selectedness, the moderate level of religiousness as well, because religiousness tends to uphold ethnocentrism and thus group selectedness, then we were fine. But with the collapse of religiousness to the level it's gone down to now and the collapse of ethnocentrism, our intelligence is just not enough. It doesn't matter that we're more clever than them. They're so much more group selected than us, and we're so individualistic and deracinated and decadent that we can be destroyed.
Well, yeah, it does seem that all the intelligence in the world is kind of useless if you don't have ethnocentrism to direct it.
No.
I mean, it's like having the weapon but not having any will to use the weapon.
It's the combination of the two. It's having a more intelligent society. Europeans are are less group selected than, let's say, East Asians, and they're less intelligent, but they're also more original in their thinking. They produce more per capita geniuses, so this makes them more successful, and so they can dominate East Asian societies, at least traditionally. Equally with Islam, okay, we're perhaps less group selected in a lot of ways, but we're more intelligent, and so we can dominate them with superior technology. But that only works if the level of group selectedness, the level of ethnocentrism, and thus religiousness, doesn't fall below a certain level. And once it does, because mortality salience is too low, let's say, because religiousness is associated with mortality salience, or simply because, as I've looked at elsewhere, this idea of the spiteful mutant, that once you get the collapse of Darwinian selection, then you get the rise of people who would have 40% of child mortality goes down to 1%. What that means is you're going to get all of these people that would have died under Darwinian conditions. They wouldn't have passed on their genes because they've got poor immune systems. They've got maladaptations of the body. And they're going to get more and more of this dysgenics. Maladaptations of the body correlate with maladaptations of the mind, because the mind is 80% of the genome. And so if you've got a maladaptation of the body, you're very likely to have a maladaptation of the mind. And so you're going to get a rise in all of these people with these maladaptive ideas that would have been maladaptive under Darwinian conditions, such as atheism, which is shown it's negatively associated with fertility, it's negatively associated with mental health, it's negatively associated with physical health, it's associated with left-handedness, which is a marker of mutation often, it's associated with autism, which is itself...
That's very unfortunate, because I am left-handed.
So am I.
Oh, good.
So it's also associated with outlier high IQ. Perhaps that's why we both are. And it's almost certainly a evidence of mutation, multiculturalism, i.e., putting the interests of other ethnic groups before your own. These can all be seen as feminism, i.e., women basically destroying their chances of passing on their genes in pursuit of a career. All of these things can be regarded as maladaptive, spiteful mutations, which have risen as we have become dysgenic as a population. So that's probably also relevant to their rise, as well as low stress. And so what you have in Islam is people who, A, have been under Darwinian selection for longer, So they're less mutated, they're less maladaptive. B, they've been they're more religious, therefore they're more ethnocentric to such a degree that you would expect them to displace us. And that's another thing that perhaps we've seen over the last decade as well, is even more clear evidence of the rise of Islam in the West.
One thing that occurs to me, is it true that the middle class are more conformist? Because it seems to me that they really, really are. Are they more conformist than the working class or the upper class?
I don't know if they're more... There's a number of dimensions to that. So what makes you middle class? Well, one of those, one thing is intelligence. Intelligence predicts socioeconomic status. So an and being educated. Education is predicted by intelligence. So what is it that makes you good in education? Well, one of those things is intelligence, and there is evidence that intelligence makes you more, in some ways, more conformist. It is associated with these burger values of being very, very pro-social and this sort of thing. And it's also associated with being able to better realize what the dominant worldview is and essentially force yourself to believe it. This is known as it's my colleague Michael Woodley's theory. I forget the name of the theory, but and so it's been found that the more intelligent a child is, the more likely he is to adopt liberal values over time as he is exposed to them, because he understands the benefit of doing so. The second thing that predicts being middle class is conscientiousness. Education is 0.55 associated with conscientiousness, rule following. So that's about being conformist and whatever. So I wouldn't be surprised. People who are working class have lower conscientiousness and they have lower IQ. So you would actually, in that sense, expect them to be less conformist. And you would expect middle class people to be more conformist. That would make sense. Yeah. Another thing about middle class is it a big part of it, even if you go back to the 16th century, is they define themselves against the working class and the upper class by kind of ideology, by characteristics like morality and religiousness and whatever. So you have the Puritans. I may not be as rich as you, but I'm more moral than you. I'm more godly than you. I'm going to go to heaven. I'm part of the elect, you know, this kind of idea. And then that kind of transmutes over time into critiquing religiousness, because it's I'm more intellectual than you. And so I critique things. And so you can say that's nonconformist, but it's nonconformist in such a way as to be part of a broader ideology, which is itself highly conformist and group, part of virtue signaling and competing for status within a group. And so there's this questioning dimension to it, but it's questioning in such a way as to in a very small way. So what you do is you conform, but you question the current ideology to show off your intelligence, but you show it off in such a way that ultimately you're basically conforming. I think that's what they do. You get this a lot in academia.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. Let's talk about that briefly, and then I want to move on to the upper class. Academia, it's like journalism, it's assumed to be a sector in which people seek the truth. What would you say about that?
That's a beautifully naive, charming view of the kind that a puppy might have. In theory, yeah. I mean, there was a period of time, perhaps when we were at our most intelligent, kind of people born in the 1850s, 60s, where that's what academia was supposed to be about. I mean, you had to be in Oxford or Cambridge University or whatever. You had to be Church of England, but as long as you were Church of England and you conform in that way, then you could go off and do what you wanted. And increasingly, academia has fallen away from that for a number of reasons. So first of all, I think we're becoming less intelligent. We know we've got data on that. I mean, the percentage of the population with alleles that are associated with very high educational attainment and not very high intelligence is falling over time. We are becoming less intelligent, and that's because basically having large families is happens by accident now with good contraception. It's people with low IQ and people that really want them, but basically people with low IQ that have. So there's a 0.1 negative association.
Dysgenic situation. That's very obvious.
So we're becoming less intelligent, and so therefore, one of the things that intelligence is associated with is truthfulness and honesty and things like this. And so you would expect us to become less focused on the truth for that reason alone. Secondly, with these spiteful mutants I talked about earlier, what would make them spiteful is that they would take over the organs of power with their ideology. And I think that that's exactly what they would do with universities. And so their ideas, such as multiculturalism, such as atheism, such as would start to sort of take over the university. As for atheism, interestingly, when the universities were founded, one of the things that marked them out was that they were religious and people believed in God. And scientists kind of saw their purpose as revealing the nature of God's creation. And consequently, to lie about the empirical reality, that was blasphemous. That was appalling. I mean, that was the kind of thing that would get you sent to hell. And that idea, that fundamental focus on the truth, on the idea of the truth as something out there, almost like traditionalism, you know, something metaphysical that verifies truth claims, that continued for a very long time, that idea of this absolute focus on the truth. And things have brought this down, the spiteful mutants, as I said, inculcating it with their ideologies, which are not based around truth, they're based around dogma. I think another issue is women, frankly. So the rise of women, and they said this in the 1900 or whatever it was, when they started letting women into Oxford and Cambridge and such like places, they were very concerned about it. And they limited it to 1 in 6 eventually. They said 1 in 6 students may be women. And then some of them went back on it and just banned women, because they said what the university is about fiercely debating ideas and getting to the truth. And we can't have people getting upset about this. We can't have people, oh, you disagree with me and it makes me feel
and
bad.
And the thing is, that would now be decried as a sexist statement, and yet look at the results of letting women into the university. I mean, that is constantly...
And so what does it do? There seems to me to be two key things. So first of all, you let women into the university. Women are less interested, as far as I can see, in the empirical truth than men. At the extreme, you have Simon Baron Cohen talks about empathy at one extreme and systematizing at the other. And the extreme male brain is highly focused on systematizing. It's basically autistic. And the extreme female brain is highly focused on empathizing. So it's very empathetic, but it's essentially system blind. Now, what you had was that when universities were dominated by men, was you had this focus on the truth, on systematizing and whatever. As you let females in, of course, you're going to let them in as well, because who comes across better in an interview for an academic position? Some genius man who's going to be very high in IQ, but he's going to be kind of antisocial and autistic and weird and difficult to work with, this sort of Isaac Newton type. Who's going to come across better? Him? Or some pretty young girl who's a head girl type at a school, who's pretty and works really hard and she's socially skilled and she's oh so interested in the social history of the Tudor period or whatever it is, you know, the history of the wool trade in Leicestershire or whatever. And of course she's going to get the job. And so it then starts to alter the nature of the department and alter the atmosphere of the department. And the department starts to get recast along female lines. What do they like, females? They're high in conscientiousness and agreeableness. So agreeableness, they don't like arguments, they don't like sort of forthright.
Combative.
They don't like that. So that starts to get suppressed. You've got to be careful what you say. You don't want to offend people. You start to get speech codes. You start to have to be careful what you say. And conscientiousness, so it starts to be about, you know, the kind of good girl that needs to be marked on her essays at school. You want to have publish a certain number of papers in a certain number of journals, and that means you've achieved what you need to achieve. Forget whether it's original or not. No, it needs to just be the usual academic thing where you just get something that someone else has written, add a bit on the end. Well, that's research, that is. Nothing original. And so it starts to drive out of the university, literally make it impossible for these genius types that university was there to nurture. I look at this in my book, The Genius Famine with Bruce Charlton, was there to nurture. Well, they're driven out. They hate conferences. They are autistic and can't deal with speech codes. They're fascinated by the truth. They're not interested in getting on with people or whatever. They're actually very difficult to get on with. And so they're kind of driven out of the university increasingly. To the extent that people that are kind of shadows of them are there, life is very difficult for them as well. And it gets worse and worse. And there was that Italian academic, I forget his name, Alexander Strumio or something. And he made the completely sensible and reasonable comment that it's a problem having women in physics, because when you have these debates with them about stuff, they get upset and cry. And then this woman called Jess Wade or something, Dr. Jess Wade, who's a 30-year-old physics student, of course, got upset and cried, went on TV and got upset about it.
Wasn't that James Lovelock? I think that...
I checked that block, it may have said something, but I think this guy was Alexander Strumio few years ago. And so it alters the nature of the university from being a place that's about ideas and the truth to being about getting on with people and following rules and women type things. And these are antithetical to the truth. And so, therefore, genuine important research has no choice but to move outside of the university, and you get independent researchers like me and my colleagues.
What about this? You see, I think this is a lot of the research that you see coming out of universities now that is touted on Twitter and the like is essentially a study in why aren't people conforming? Like that thing about the alternative influencer network. There was no question of whether the alternative had any merit. It was just an assumed outrage that there was an alternative and that people were taking interest in it. Like, how dare people go for something alternative? That's extraordinarily feminine, and it's stereotypically feminine in its attitude.
Yeah, that's indeed the case, and also it's religious in its attitude. So one of the things that you had in the past, there was a book by my colleague Bruce Charlton called "Not Even Trying," and he said, "Well, the thing is that if you go back to Victorian England, there was a period of time, a brief period of time, where we were trying to get the best people, the cleverest minds, get those people into universities and give them a space where they could do something brilliant. If they, you know, and that's another thing, that this thing that you have to do research assessment exercise and whatever, and you have to publish how many papers, how many, you know, every 4 years. Geniuses don't work like that. They want to work on their problem until they solve it. That's it. And it might take them 10 years, 20 years. And they don't want to have, but under the current female regimen of conscientiousness, that's not good enough. You've got to publish a certain number of papers and all this. So it simply undermines the whole thing. But the point is that when a religion takes over, that becomes more important than the truth. You had this in medieval Europe and whatever, it was Christianity. The most important thing was that you accepted the dogmas of the church and other things, you know, that you've been to a certain kind of public school and that you were from a certain part of the country and that you were from a certain gentry family, and being clever was quite far down the list. We're in a similar situation now at universities, where you've got they want you to be a woman, they want you to be black, they want you to be disabled, they want you to be from a certain economic background, and being actually intelligent and likely to do something brilliant, that's quite far down the list. So we're not even trying. And so what this does is it just undermines confidence. I mean, I mentioned earlier this state fragility in the polarization of societies, where confidence is undermined in state institutions. Well, I think one of those is the university, because we know what bollocks comes out of the universities now, or this nonsensical, non-replicated research. Most extreme was there was this Dutch researcher a few years ago called, what was his name? And he basically had all this left-wing research. So he apparently proved that Deirdre Staples, he apparently proved that if an area is lots of rubbish in it and it's dirty, it makes people more racist. And lots of other useful things like that. And it was all shown to be fake and made up. He had no interest in the truth. He just wanted to promote his ideology. And so I think the faith in university is being undermined, I think, and evidently.
Yes. Well, of course, the recent Brexit referendum and then this new general election a few weeks ago is a perfect example of how the elite are simply not trusted. Now, obviously, it's a different elite that we're talking about, but I think it's the same reason and the whole same syndrome that's going on there. The elite are not trusted in any way. I made this point in the speech in Copenhagen a few months ago, that we have this situation now where nobody can rely. I mean, you know, the elite tell you that there is no such thing as male and female. You know, that's what you're supposed to look up to as wisdom. You're supposed to accept that, and no matter how baffling and troubling it is, you're supposed to integrate it into your worldview, which of course means that you've got to end up with a fucked up worldview.
Well, yes, and it's a problem for them that they've taken it so far. People have been made to integrate into their worldview things which, on a certain level, they know aren't true, and so it triggers them when they are confronted about it, such as that race differences are all down to environment or that they don't exist. Or, I mean, I even had a friend that got very upset, a former friend, a woke person, who in 2011, when I commented that it was black riots in London, which it obviously empirically was, and this upset him. Because it questioned his worldview.
There's a fantastic blog that I've hawked several times on the channel called Hum Stats, meaning human stats. I think if you just Google Hum Stats, you'll find this fantastic breakdown of the demographics, the areas where the riots happened. It's absolutely irrefutable that it was about race, for sure.
No, indeed, what provoked it was a particular black criminal being shot by the police. That was what set it off. So it was obviously understandable in terms of genetic similarity and in terms of race. I mean, that's what started it. But anyway, and so they kind of get upset about these things, and they kind of try to suppress their. But it's so obviously insane when it gets to a point where women are being told you should have a man in your changing room, or you know, a biological man, or you naked. Or you should have a biological man on your sports team. It's very good that this woman, and I follow the darts. I'm a big fan of the darts, and there's this woman that's doing very well in the dart in the PDC darts championship at the moment. She's got through to, I don't know how far it is. She won't get to the final. I don't see her up against Michael Van Gerwen or whatever, but she's doing well. Fine. It's always been the case with darts. There is separation. There is women's darts, but women are allowed in. But in general, if you let men into women's sports, they're always going to win. I mean, the other way around, if you were going to let even people that aren't very good, like, I don't know, Dave Chisnell, into women's darts. So it's crazy. And that's why one wonders if it's peak woke. But I'm not sure it is, because there'll always be and when that kind of thing happens, then people have this tendency, particularly if they're intelligent, to force themselves to believe what's useful for their benefit. And so you might get them moving, people who are now very quite woke, moving away from this into a more conservative direction as the wind blows in that direction. But I suspect with the level of mutation that we have, you're going to get people basically moving toward paedophilia and trying to make paedophilia acceptable. That seems to me to be the next thing.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, I for a long time I was very skeptical that the left would go there, but they seem to be doing it now, and via they find this ingenious delivery mechanism for that, which is the trans issue. So they can sexualize a 7-year-old on the auspices that the 7-year-old is a transsexual of some kind, and therefore you can't object to this 7-year-old being sexualized without being transphobic.
Yes, it's very clever.
It's very clever indeed. They've really laid the groundwork, and one thing leads to another.
And also, I mean, it's kind of psychological abuse to have. If you look at the correlates of transsexuality, it's things like narcissism is a key correlate of transsexuality. They have elevated levels of narcissism. They have, because what's it saying? If you say that, there's no objective reality outside me. If I assert I'm a woman, then I am a woman. And there was that case in Britain recently. There was this biological woman who was transitioning to be a man, and then she decided that she wanted to have a baby, and that's her right. So she kind of transitioned back, and then she had the baby, and then she transitioned back fully, wanted to being a man, and then wanted to be put as the father on the birth certificate. So she wanted the kind of Stalinist falsification of history, because to not do that would hurt her feelings. Yeah. I mean, it's quite brilliant.
Well, one last thing on the issue of the university. I think a dangerous notion that people can have is that intelligence equals a desire for truth-seeking, whereas often it's not that at all. It's almost quite separate, because often intelligence can be a desire simply for, first of all, delusion. The intelligence enables you to delude yourself, enables you to rationalize any belief at all. But also it's... as you said, a path towards social conformity and maximizing your social currency.
Yes, that's right. So there's various correlates of intelligence, and one of them is honesty. People who are intelligent do tend to be more, on average, more, but these are only weak correlations, more honest. But others are that they're more trusting. And so trusting is associated then with conformity and believing people and whatever. One of the correlates of intelligence is openness. which is a personality trait, and this is associated with being hypnotizable, and inculcated with things, and then one of them is my side bias. So people who are intelligent are less likely to regard themselves as possibly biased than people who are less intelligent. So there's all kinds of ways in which being intelligent actually mediates against truth. It's not if the genius is the ultimate pursuer of truth, it's not intelligence that predicts in itself that predicts the pursuit of truth. It's intelligence plus this moderately antisocial personality. Because if you are intelligent and you have the social personality, you'll be agreeable, which will make you want to. And what is middle classness? Middle is intelligence plus relatively high agreeableness, which makes you conformist and feminine, basically feminine traits. Intelligence plus quite feminine traits is associated with being middle class. What these geniuses are about is intelligence plus quite masculine traits, i.e. low agreeableness and low conscientiousness, literally testosterone, or androgens. We've actually done studies on this in terms of per capita Nobel Prizes. I've been an author on two studies on this. So if you take per capita science Nobel Prizes as a marker of national genius, and you look only at countries with an IQ above 90, which takes in 98% of countries that have ever won science Nobel Prizes. So you've basically controlled for intelligence. What predicts per capita Nobel Prizes then is per capita androgens, markers of testosterone. No balls, no Nobel. That's how it works. So we're talking things like average number of sexual partners, mid-pelagial hair, which is hair on the fingers, 2D-4D ratio, which is a testosterone marker, CAG, number of repeats on the CAG gene, and various other markers, prostate cancer, and various other markers of testosterone. It's that that predicts it. That's why Northeast Asians don't win many per capita Nobel Prizes, even though they're more intelligent than Europeans, because they don't. They're lower in testosterone. They don't produce these genius types, which is an unlikely combination, because at the group level, class level, intelligence goes with these feminine traits, high conscientiousness and high agreeableness. So it's a very unlikely thing, but it's the genius, that kind of person, very high IQ, moderately low in agreeableness. That's what's in, and conscientiousness. That's what's interested in. That's the truth thing. Very high IQ can predict just being very conformist and left wing and being in Mensa and playing card games.
Right. One quick question, then on to a different topic, and then we'll do the super chats. So the quick question is, you said that autism is, and this is an obvious question, but I want to ask you it because I've never really asked anyone this. Autism is extreme male brainness.
To some extent, yes.
So what would be the equivalent for extreme femaleness?
Schizophrenia.
Schizophrenia?
Well, aspects thereof, yeah.
Right, okay. Thank you.
So if you think about what empathy... if you have extreme empathy, then you are obsessed with the feelings of others. Empathy involves being able to observe the external states of others and intuit their internal states. And schizophrenics are obsessed with this. And they're obsessed with it. They overread the markers of internal states. And so they will read love where it should just be, I quite like you. They will read murderous intent where it should just be, I'm annoyed. They overread states. And they become paranoid. And that's the essence of schizophrenia. And they tend to have utterly disordered worldviews because they're very bad at systematizing. They over-empathize to a pathological degree. And it's not to say that you can't, because of the shopping list nature of autism and schizophrenia, you can be diagnosed with both. But what they are distinct on is this empathy versus systematizing.
Right. Okay. Someone else suggested something which occurred to me, which was a female nature on steroids. I once read it described as, which is borderline personality disorder. Do you know much about that?
A borderline personality disorder. Well, there's a number of different personality disorders. There's narcissism. There's histrionic disorder, which is a more male thing. There's histrionic disorder where you want to be the center of attention, which is a more female thing. There's multiple personality disorder, and these all tend to be associated with trauma, or sometimes they're genetic. Or narcissism is highly genetic. But there's a whole range of personality disorders. Some are more female, some are more associated with males.
Right, okay. Yeah, that's cluster B. I think it is
true that women are more likely to have borderline personality disorder. So borderline personality disorders are basically deeply, deeply insecure and mentally unstable. Neuroticism, that sort of thing. And thus you create this kind of false sense of self to deal with it, and that's borderline, and it can be triggered, but it's very easily offended and like that. That's borderline personality. But yeah, it is more female, that's true.
Okay, that was the quick question. The other one is the matter of, because we've spoken about the working class and the middle class, so what characterizes the upper class in a healthy state, and what are their characteristics? And what about, what kind of state are they in now in Britain?
Well, it depends who we're including in the category of upper class. But if you look at research by Greg Clark, what he finds is that between the about 1200, based on surnames, he looks at the prominence of surnames across time, and you have upper class surnames, that is to say, surnames that are French sounding or relate to a place, locative surnames, because the village name was taken by the lord of the manor, and then you have middle class surnames, that's names that do with the profession or whatever, and then working class surnames tend to be things like that relate to the way you live or what you look like, Hill, Brown. That sort of thing. And what he found is that there's this expansion of middle class surnames across time and a reduction in the working class ones and the upper class ones. And that's because what was happening every generation was that the richer 50% of the population had 100%, had double the fertility of the poorer 50% of the population. But at the same time, the upper class were being killed in battles and things like this. And this is a small population society, remember, 3 million people or whatever. Scotland, it was about a million in the 16th century. And so there's this expansion of the middle class, of these individualistic type people we were talking about earlier, and they expand. The heritability of socioeconomic status across generations was found to be 0.7, which is high. So there's a degree to which these can be understood as almost as castes. And so you'd expect there then to be clear differences, genetic differences between classes. And there are. I mean, there was a study that found, was it blood type A? And it was its percentage of people with it was much higher among the top social strata of 1 than among the bottom social strata 5. So this is a clearly genetic thing. But what seems to characterize them is really the values of the public school system. So that's what they're inculcated with. So this noblesse oblige, these group value, group selected values, this idea that you should not be individualistic. You should be quite the opposite of that, and that you should lay down your life for the society, and that you're there to serve the society, and that's your purpose, and that this noblesse oblige kind of values. That's what's always kind of, for a long time, even back to the medieval period, characterized the upper class. Those values cross over to some extent the values of the working class, because the working class also have these values of being patriotic and tough and fighters and that sort of thing, and also connected strongly to their family and to a sense of place and belonging, which the upper class also have. It's the middle class traditionally that are the nowheres rather than the somewheres, and have these individualistic values which are rather the different. In terms of the state of the upper class,
Before we get into that, can we talk more about I want to distinguish the upper class from the working class in terms of their values and their tendencies, their behavioural tendencies.
Well, the upper class, in terms of their values, the upper class will tend to there was a very interesting study on this by someone called Kate Fox. It was called Watching the English, and she looked at how the upper class, what they're interested in is ancestry, pedigree. What makes them who they are is their ancestors. So kind of ancestor worship. The working class don't have ancestors that are really worth worshipping, and so what makes them who they are is things like physical toughness, physical ability,
resilience,
ability, that sort of thing. Whereas what makes the middle class who they are is things like education and morality, and maybe religiosity, or it used to be, or the replacement of it. So the middle class are individualistic and motivated by ideals, if you like, whereas with the working class, it's much more just every day getting through. And with the upper class, it's again traditionalism and whatever. And they play a part in both. So the upper class and the working class tend to be traditionalist and hold on to traditions. The working class, perhaps because they are low in intelligence, and this makes you conservative. And the upper class, because they are high in just this general group selectedness that they've been bred for, which you fall out of the upper class if you're not into, and the middle class in individualism. That's very simplifying it, but I think that's pretty much the and that's why you can see why the working class and the upper class are kind of secure in their position in a sense, and are not trying to be anything they're not often, and whatever. If the working class do move up into the middle class, often they won't adopt middle class values. They'll be rich. They'll have the wealth of being middle class because they are, but they won't talk like them or have the interests that they have. Whereas there is a pretension. One of the things is swearing. So there was an analysis of this. According to the purity rule of Mary Douglas, who's this anthropologist, the closer you are to the centre of power, the more pure you are. So the more restrained you are in your behaviour and how you, the more pure you're supposed to kind of be. But it doesn't actually work like that, because the middle class overcompensate. They're pretentious. They try and be more upper class than the upper class. And so in terms of swearing, the socioeconomic group that swears the most is the working class, then the upper class, then the middle class. And that is consistent with the insecurity of the middle class. The middle class are striving. They're trying to be something that they're not. And they overcompensate to the extent that on that measure of purity, and many others as well, religiousness and whatever, they are more upper class than the upper class, even though they're not upper class by any reasonable definition of the word.
It's fake it till you make it, I guess.
Yes, yeah, yeah. But they don't make it, though. They don't make it into the upper class. They have this different set of values. And that's the worst thing about them, that it's characterised by morality, by feeling I'm better than you. The working class don't feel they're better than anybody, and the upper class, to a degree, are inculcated to not feel they're better than people through this system of the public schools and, you know, regular beatings and buggery. But the middle class do. They haven't. They need to suffer more, I think, really. The upper class suffer at public schools, the working class suffer.
That's definitely something that I've perceived about them, in the terms of the class dynamic. I think that the middle class are pampered. And I've said this back in, I think, 2015, I did a video about this, the entitled middle class. I think the difference is the working class lack optimism. The upper class tend to be optimistic, but the middle class have optimism, but not, it's of a sort of embryonic kind, and it's limited. The middle class are optimistic when things are going their way and within a certain context, but outside of that, they struggle. They're inherently
don't want to be what they are. They're desperate not to fall into the working class, and they know they'll never really get into the upper class because that's kind of hereditary. Their son might be upper class, but they won't be. And so they kind of try to overcompensate and kind of repel that in a kind of the lady doth protest too much, methinks, way by stressing values and ideology and religion in the old days and now leftist ideas and critiquing things and undermining tradition and undermining really group selection and that which is useful in surviving the battle of group selection. And that's what they do. I think they're now a severe problem. The middle class are too influential now, I think, in European countries, particularly in Britain. The Joe Swinson types, just these appalling head girl types
made a point of quite a few times that Rotherham is a very middle class thing. The scandal, I think, absolutely arises from middle class behavior, from their tendencies. So they are very conformist, very self righteous, great capacity to delude themselves, obsessed with their own virtue, and they have contempt for the working class.
Working class, they have contempt for the working class, and so they are happy to let this happen. And also, their ideology causes them to their maladaptive ideology of multiculturalism causes them to have a kind of love for the Asians, in a way that they don't for the white working class, whom they regard as just scum, basically as just the rabble. And it's always been like that. There was a very interesting book on this, Tony McHenry, his name is, I forget the title of the book. It's a very interesting book. He looks at these moral panics. Going all the way back to the 16th century, you get this history in England. It's punctuated by moral panics. And these are almost always middle class moral panics. over working class and upper class behaviour. An example of the influence is how it was quite acceptable until the 1600s and the rise of Puritanism for upper class men to have mistresses quite openly who they would have children by. Henry VIII openly, when he was with Catherine of Aragon, had a mistress who was Henry Fitzroy, who he died in 1536, aged 17. But all the mistresses, it was fine. And then by the time Victoria came to the throne and there was this heavy influence from the Puritan middle class, then she banned these various royal bastards from court because it had become increasingly unacceptable. It was middle classness across the Victorian era that pushed away the kind of frivolity and sexual license of the 18th century. Now, there was things that were good about that because it made us as a nation. There's research by J.D. Unwin which finds that as nations become more intelligent, they become more sexually restrained and whatever. And then when they reach their peak, they're very sexually restrained. And then you know a society is in decline when it becomes less sexually restrained, which is what's happened to us, of course. But because intelligence is associated with poor impulse, high impulse control and things like that. But so they do have benefits to the middle class. The Industrial Revolution was a product of the middle class. There are benefits to the middle class. There's questioning of things and whatever. But there are clear downsides. It's getting the balance right. And that balance at the level of the superorganism has gone very wrong.
Okay, so finally, the state of the upper class today.
Well, they've been in decline for a very long time. We haven't had an upper class, a properly upper class prime minister. Well, putting aside David Cameron. So there was a long period from 1964, Sir Alec Douglas Hume, Earl of Hume. And then you had a long period where you had to have all these middle class people, grammar school boys who were from middle class backgrounds, such as Wilson, whose parents were school teachers, such as Callaghan, similar sort of thing, such as Heath. I think it's a similar kind of background again. Lower middle class, Thatcher, grocer, lower middle class. Blair, it was more kind of upper, major, sort of lower middle, really. Blair, but upper middle, public school boy, but kind of the lower end of that, sort of upper middle. Brown, we're back to middle class, vicar's son. And then finally with Cameron, there's this period of the ascent then, of the upper class and a feeling as well that the class war's over. And there was a feeling for a long time that, oh, you couldn't possibly have an upper class prime minister. No, that would never work. They'd never be voted for. No, there always has to be, or even a private school prime minister. It has to be state school and whatever. But there's a genuineness to Cameron, in a sense, to Cameron, and particularly to Boris, much more so, and not to Theresa May, who's the grammar school vicar's daughter, which people like. And appeals to the working class because it's a genuineness that they have and they
yes
so I think the state of the upper class is perhaps improved of the traditional upper class in recent years.
Yes, I think so. Okay, we'll go to questions now. So if you have super chats, now is the time to post them. How big a portion of the immigrant vote do the Conservatives get, and do you think England can be saved? It seems to me, out of all European countries, they're in the absolute worst position. So how big a portion of the immigrant vote do the Conservatives get, and do you think England can be saved?
I don't know how big a portion of the immigrant vote the Conservatives get. I'll have to check. But I do think that England could possibly be saved. Conservatives percent. I'm not sure. It's not particularly high. In the general election of 23rd, no, this is the wrong country. I don't know the. I think they get about 30% of the immigrant vote or something like that. So it's. I think that's right. I'm not sure. But Labour get most of the immigrant vote, that's for sure. Do I think England can be saved? I think there are signs of it. I mean, I think Brexit is a sign that perhaps the English are waking up. I think the vote for Boris Johnson is a sign that the English are waking up. But the organs of power are still thoroughly held by the left. In the long run, you mentioned earlier, was something about a white pill. I could give this one of my white pills now, which is in the long run, I would say yes. And what predicts that is breeding patterns. So what predicts breeding is low intelligence, which is associated with conservatism, is literally conservatism. So being people who are conservative in Western countries have more children than people who are liberal, and is religiousness, which is associated with conservatism. And the heritability of these things is quite high. The heritability of religiousness is about 0.4. The heritability of political perspective is about 0.4 or 0.5. The heritability of intelligence is 0.8. And so on that basis, what you would predict is that the country would increasingly become more conservative. What would hold it back would be living standards being high enough to make people so low in stress that they're not particularly religious, one. Two would be spiteful mutants inculcating them with maladaptive ideologies. That would hold it back. But those things wouldn't last forever, because the spiteful mutant ideologies would lead to a state eventually of war and conflict and polarization, which would make people more stressed, more religious, more instinctive, more ethnocentric. And the declining intelligence will ultimately lead to a situation where we go backwards. Only today or yesterday, was it, they tried to get a rocket to the space station and ballsed it up. I mean, these are the kind of little things that will go wrong. As society becomes less intelligent, I think we won't be able to do things we used to be able to do. The world will become more stressed. Also, ethnic diversity inherently leads to stress. There's lots of conflict. So I would say that in the future, we will become more conservative. And there's even signs of it. So Twenge, a woman called Twenge, and she's done this interesting research on iGen, the generation born in the late 90s that were raised knowing only the internet. Those people are on certain measures more conservative than people of my age or 10 years younger than me. They lose their virginity later. They get girlfriends and boyfriends the first time later. They leave home later. They learn to drive later, if at all. They are more conservative on a lot of ways. So I would be cautiously optimistic that eventually the current woke wave will crash.
Okay. Someone says, "Woes, you burnt out hero with the right. You're called back to the movement like an 80s action film." Thank you very much. Question for both of you. Do you think that the UK will still be majority white British by 2066? Do you think a random event will happen or the mood will shift in order to reverse the trend that we see now? So will Britain still be majority white British by 2066?
I wouldn't have thought so. I think on current trends, that's very unlikely, unless there was some kind of war or very dramatic event. And there could be. I mean, it's been predicted the 2020s is going to be a period of incredible conflict by Peter Turch and this Russian researcher. So there could be. But on current trends, no. And that would be the kind of thing that would then make England reawake. That kind of being a minority, being under stress, that's exactly the kind of thing that would assist it. It would like a reconquista.
Yeah, I agree on both of those counts. I think that if we did become a minority, that would not be the end of the story. And also, I think it wouldn't be surprising if we don't become a minority, because things are heating up all the time. So on either count, I don't think there's cause for pessimism, or certainly not fatalism, defeatism. No. Okay, which king is the ancestor of all living English people today? Ed has spoken of this before.
Edward III.
Right. Okay, thank you. Why does Ed love talking to midgets at pubs?
This is a Scottish person, I won't name him, who lives in Oulu and is a based gentleman. And I was with him in the pub in Oulu, and there were these two midgets. And they were very midget. I mean, they were midget, even by midget standards, and very dolled up and pretty, you know, makeup and whatever. And I just got chatting to them, and I went over and talked. They spoke very good English, and I just chatted to them. And eventually, I said to them, "Would I fit in your house?" Just as a joke, just to break the ice. And apparently, they do live in normal sized houses. So yeah, that's it is enjoyable. It's actually noticeable. Finland has a small gene pool, and as a consequence, now it's not under harsh Darwinian selection anymore. You do get a lot. You do notice there's a lot of inbreeding, I suppose, really, without meaning to inbreed. I mean, we English or British are all the English, let's say, are all related to Edward III, and we're all related. Once you get back to about the 1500s, we have common ancestor. We're all about 12th cousins.
Right.
Icelandic people are all about third cousins, probably, and Finnish people, I don't know what they'd be, sixth cousins, fifth cousins, something like that. The result of that is you get these genetic problems, and dwarfism is one thing that's very noticeable here. I've never really seen any people that are dwarfs in England, but here it's very noticeable. Yeah.
And when you say dwarf, what kind of height are we talking about?
Well, I don't know, four foot or something, 3 foot.
Bloody hell.
I mean, these girls were about 3 foot. They were so small that I was coming out of the loo in the pub, and I thought, for God's sake, why has someone let their little two-year-old or whatever in here? They were short, even by the standards of people with dwarfism. They were incredibly short, both of them. That's perhaps right. Why they were, yeah.
Did you, right, okay. And like, did you have to sort of crouch down to talk to them?
Well, they were sitting down. They went and sat down at the obviously their feet didn't touch the ground, but they went and sat down at the a pub in Oulu. It used to be called the Nuclear Nightclub. I forget what it's called now. And we had a chat. I had quite a lot to drink. It has to be said. Like, there was this, I think it was that the same night there was this Dutch person that kept buying me beer. That was the same night. I think I fell off my bike and smashed my nose in. It was a fun night.
Oh, right. Okay. Good. I'm glad it turned out well. All right. What is the Jolly Heretic's opinion on porn? Styx recently had a debate with E. Michael Jones regarding this, and I want to hear the Jolly Heretic's opinion on this. Porn.
My opinion on...
porn.
It depends on the kind of porn. I mean, what do you mean?
Well, I think he means it's a general moral issue and social phenomenon. How do you think it affects?
I think, as I said, I was interviewed by this Robin Riley girl the other day, and she asked me about this. And I said, when I was younger, you'd get the concept of the porn fairies. You know, you'd walk home from school and somebody randomly left porn in the bushes. And that was, of course, the responsibility of the porn fairies. And otherwise, you didn't see porn. There was no porn anywhere. I mean, if I'd been 13 years old, we'd be typing in whatever perverted stuff into the Google. So it must be quite a weird thing now for people who are 13 years old to have such easy access to pornography. I mean, my son's only seven, so he's not got interested in it yet. It must be odd. If we're a people highly patriarchal society in which people protect their females. They protect their females to some degree through kind of purdah, through covering them up so that they don't arouse other males. So it could be argued there's a degree to which we are literally not evolved to be surrounded by nudity. And if you're in a society where there is lots of nudity, hunter gatherer or whatever, then you'll evolve to be able to deal with it. Because if you're going to see it all the time, if you're going to go and rape the woman, then you're going to get killed by the band. So you have to be able to deal with it. Once that's taken away, then you're not adapted to deal with constant nudity, and so one can see how that might be a problem. And it would also explain perhaps why it is that when Muslims come to Western countries and they see all these scantily dressed women, they just can't stop themselves. Because they perhaps are literally not evolved to be able to deal with it, with nudity, let alone porn. So I can see how it would be a problem. I'm not in favour of banning it, but I think that I don't know. The libertarian in me would be opposed to this sort of thing. I don't know, but I don't know how they can. I don't know what they can do really, other than ban the internet. I mean, once they allowed the internet, they knew it was going to be mainly about porn. I mean, that was obvious.
Okay. All right. James Wood says, no problem with my three kids understanding gender roles. And then he asks, why do white people not care at all about being destroyed by, demographic change?
Oh, I see. You've censored that question.
Yes.
Okay, well, one possibility would be to do with, we were talking earlier about testosterone, and what testosterone is associated with is being aggressive and whatever and fighting and all this sort of thing. And there's evidence that because we're now in this kind of mouse utopia, really, where we haven't been under, we would have been under selection until 1800 to be highly ethnocentric and care very deeply about things like demographic change. And so now we're going to have a rise in all of these people with all these mutations that would have been selected out, including people that don't care about demographic change or that absolutely want it. So the first thing you're going to get is these spiteful mutants that would have died out because they would have poor immune systems. Poor immune system would correlate with poor mental health, and they get to positions of power, and then they inculcate the society to think in maladaptive ways because the society is very inculcatable, very hypnotizable. So that's one reason why we wouldn't care about demographic change. Just be inculcated it with these people that have taken structures. We are evolved to live in a religious society to a certain degree. If you undermine religiousness, then you undermine all that religiousness promotes. And religiousness tends to promote adaptive things, such as ethnocentrism and is the will of God, or whatever, traditional ideas that are adaptive of the will of God. So that's one reason. A second reason is the general dysgenics has caused a collapse in testosterone levels. We know that from data in the USA, and so that's going to make us less aggressive and more passive and less inclined to fight back. A third thing you could argue is the rise of feminism, which has feminized males. Males are now inculcated from school onwards with these feminine cooperative, you know, values. They're told it's bad to be male. They're told that anything male is kind of pathologized. This is going to make them depressed because they're in a situation that they're not adapted to. It's going to make them less aggressive and whatever. And so that's another reason. A third reason could be, I wonder if women are becoming more masculinized. That's quite possible. There's evidence that, cystic ovary syndrome is rising, and that's associated with testosterone. With the mouse Utopia, which your viewers may not be familiar with, they had a group of mice in University of Maryland in the late 60s. They took away basically Darwinian conditions, so it was a mouse utopia, no predation, whatever, a perfect place. Over many generations, first of all, there's a massive expansion, as took place with us. Then the breeding starts to slow down. Then the population starts to fall. And as that happens, they notice weird things. The females are more masculinized and throw their young out of the nest too young, and so the young don't socialize properly. And then the males are having to be pestered for sex, and they become more kind of feminized. And then you have this caste called the beautiful ones, who are not interested in territory, they're not interested in anything, they just groom each other and drink water and whatever. And eventually all the mice are autistic weirdos and beautiful ones or aggressive women that don't have children that die out. And so that's what you predict to happen to us. So that would explain why we don't care about our replacement.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I mean, that's a famous thing that has been talked about for several years, the Mouse Utopia experiment, and it's really quite scary. All right. Have you been reading any books lately?
Have I been reading any books? Yes, I have. I was reviewing this book called The Identitarians. So yesterday, it's a kind of ethnographic piece of quite neutral, actually, research on the, you know, the cultural alt-right, whatever. So I read that book yesterday. No, I haven't.
Okay. How do you view transhumanism?
As I said, someone asked about this on my show, it's nonsense. We're never going to get that far for transhumanism to happen. Our intelligence is going down. It's been going down since 1800. We're now at the level of per capita inventions we were in 1600. We're at the vocabulary level that we were in 1700. We're becoming less intelligent, and it's never ever going to happen. Indeed, one of the reasons for that might solve the Fermi paradox, my colleague Michael Woodley has argued this, is that societies always rise and fall like this. They never get intelligent enough to be able to go into, you know, travel of that kind, and so therefore aliens are never discovered. And it could be good reasons for that, because once people get highly intelligent, they tend to become disinterested in breeding, they tend to become moderately autistic, and so on. And so if society became too intelligent, it could be argued it would be disinterested in breeding and it would just die out. So there is a degree to which society can't become too intelligent. The species will survive, and that means stopping it from becoming too intelligent, and always does stop it from doing so, because once a certain level of intelligent comfort is reached, then intelligence becomes negatively associated with breeding and intelligence goes down again.
Okay. There's a guy in the comments saying that he is a 6'3" successful black man, and then asking why I hate him. So just let me say, I don't hate you.
Have you met him?
No, but I'm pretty, therefore I don't hate him, you know.
Yeah.
So anyway, someone asks thoughts about Kant Lee R and his book Time to Go Mobile.
I'm not familiar with it. I shall look it up.
All right. All right. I think I won't ask that. Right. The Jolly Heretic, have you been getting enough sleep lately? You look very tired.
I may look tired, but I'm sure I'll live longer than you.
All right. Okay, is there evidence for narcissism amongst YouTubers?
I don't know that it's been researched. I wouldn't be at all surprised if you look at some of these YouTubers that just talk about themselves and their feelings and stuff. It's pretty narcissistic. So I don't know if it's been researched. I'm not familiar with it having been researched. Certainly there's evidence of narcissism among Instagrammers. That has been researched. People take lots of photographs themselves. It's a dark triad thing.
Yes. Here's a completely different question. In your opinion, what was the saddest moment in British history?
Oh, probably the death of the Archduke of Austria-Hungary, because that set off World War One and all of the hell that's happened as a consequence. And you could argue it's directly as a consequence of that. Mm. So I'd say it's the assassination of the Archduke of Austria-Hungary.
Okay. Someone else is saying that he is a 3'4" Finnish midget. Why don't you love me? But I happen to know that the person responsible for this comment is actually a Canadian. So he's lying. All right, the last question is, what attitudes from the Victorian era do we need to rekindle to save the West?
We need to rekindle a focus on the truth. We need to rekindle a focus on a moderate respect for tradition and that sort of thing. And nationalism. One of the things you had at the late Victorian era particularly was a revived kind of British nationalism. You had statues of Alfred the Great put up in Winchester and statues of other sort of icons of the Saxon or whatever Celtic even in Scotland past put up. So there was this there was the renewed nationalism, there was a renewed traditionalism combined. That was a Victorian thing, a renewed traditionalism. So we need a renewed traditionalism. The Victorians, remember, had an IQ that was about 20 points or 15 points higher than ours.
That seems incredible.
Why?
I mean, it's just such a drastic difference.
Well, it's only the difference between a white American and a black American.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Okay. All right. Let's just move on from that. I'm scared about the rules on YouTube.
Oh, sorry.
Okay. So, no, it's fine. It's not your fault. All right. So I guess that's it. There are no more super chats. Oh, there are two more. Hope that your Oslo lecture will be posted. It was great. The camera assignment.
It's on BitChute and also it's on YouTube, but I took it down from my channel because they gave me a strike for the lecture that was at the Patriotic Alternative. So I took that down and any other lecture I'd done. But it's on BitChute and someone from the Czech Republic or something. It's in my Interviews with Jolly Heretics section on YouTube, but it's also on BitChute.
Okay. And that person also said cheers from Finland, but didn't specify their height. So the next one is, do you think Western Europeans will become religious? I just can't imagine it happening here in Scandinavia, at least not in the next 100 years.
Yes, I do, because as I said earlier, it's religiousness is the key predictor of having children. And the other one is low intelligence, and intelligence is negatively correlated with religiousness. So for those two reasons, on current trends, this is going to happen.
Right.
And I don't know where you are in Scandinavia, but there's quite a strong cultural religiousness in Finland, for example. 70% of people pay a church tax to be members of the Lutheran Church and things like that. It's in Sweden and Denmark, perhaps it's more. But in Norway and Finland, there's more influence of religion.
Mm. I think that of those four, I think Sweden is the most atheistic. I'm not sure. Any white pills for the future? Because we did.
Well, my white pill is what I just said, which is that the normal people that would have survived under Darwinian conditions, the non-mutants, are breeding. That's who breeds. That's who's passing on their genes. Whereas the cultural and genetic garbage that is the left, being left-wing, being liberal, they do not pass on their genes. So it's a passing phase of their influence. So that's my white pill. So
all right. So it's quite grimly purveyed, but still it is a white pill.
Okay, do you want me to convey it again in a kind of a happier, high-pitched voice?
Yes, do it. Yeah, go for it.
The great thing is that we are the people that breed. And the people that are on the left, the liberals, the mutants, the scum, the vermin, they don't breed. So it's going to be good, guys. It's going to be, yeah!
All right. Edward Dutton, the Jolly Heretic, thank you very much. This has been a very entertaining and informative stream. So Thank you for taking part, Millennial 2019.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Bye-bye.
Excellent. Merry Christmas. Thank you. I'll be back in about half an hour with the second guest tonight, who is Unwashed. So I will see you all then. Thank you for watching. Thank you for Jolly Heretic, Edward Dutton. See you soon.
Bye-bye.